Welcome to International Edition. I'm Ira Melvin in Washington. I had hundreds of lives taken over the past few days alone in the migrant crisis in Africa, the Middle East, and Europe. You'll hear what efforts are being taken to help resolve the situation, at least hopefully. 10 years ago, the levees in the U.S. city of New Orleans were breached. Many died, and many problems were exposed by the floodwaters. You'll hear from one person who went through it. And new words and phrases are continually being added to the English language. Here's a new one. Manspreading.
Manspreading is the practice whereby a man, especially one traveling on public transportation, adopts a sitting position with his legs wide apart in such a way as to encroach on an adjacent seat or seats.
Who would do that? There are more words. Stay with us for that. All of that and more on today's International Edition, coming right up here on The Voice of America. Well, trying to cross the wide, rough Mediterranean Sea on an overcrowded smuggler's boat is a deadly risk, even in the warm summer weather. The International Office of Migration has recorded 2,432 deaths linked to Mediterranean migrant crossings this year, but it expects that figure to rise because Libyan authorities are still counting the dead from three shipwrecks off the Libyan coast over the past couple of days. Authorities found 52 bodies in the hull of one boat off Libya on Wednesday. UN officials say another 200 are missing and feared dead after two other unseaworthy boats capsized Thursday off the western Libyan port of Zawara. Scores of smugglers' boats leave lawless Libya every day, packed with migrants trying to reach the safety of Europe. A Hungarian national police spokeswoman said this morning that four people are in custody in connection with the 71 migrants who suffocated to death in a refrigerated truck found parked on a main Austrian highway. The spokeswoman says the four detained Thursday in Hungary include three Bulgarian citizens and one person from Afghanistan. One of the Bulgarians is the owner of the truck. Nearly 20 other people were questioned as witnesses, and houses connected to the case also were searched. An Austrian police chief says police believe the suspects are part of a larger Bulgarian-Hungarian smuggling ring. Two Hungarian police detectives are in Austria helping with the case. Now, with these incidents where people were left to die by human traffickers or foundering in the waters of the Mediterranean, there's some rising calls now for action in the areas where people come from and by the countries through which they transit. Joining me, International Edition's Jeffrey Young, who's been focusing this week on the migration crisis. What have you found, Jeff?
I wrote on Thursday, Vienna, they had a summit conference between the European Union countries and also Macedonia and Serbia. And what happened in the conference, Austria put forth a plan to directly address human trafficking, to focus efforts on trying to stop as much human trafficking as possible, because that's where a great deal of the danger, such as the truckload full of people with 71 victims. The Austrian foreign minister put forth a plan that would also create safe havens. Now, interestingly, the safe havens wouldn't be in the European Union. The safe havens would be either in the countries of origin, like Syria and Libya, which is highly problematic because these places are not safe.
And they probably don't want them anyway, right?
Then, of course, yeah. You have the second layer, which is, well, let's create safe havens in the transit countries, such as Macedonia and Serbia. And guess what? Macedonia and Serbia aren't very interested in that idea because they really don't want to hold these people on behalf of the European Union so the EU can pick and choose who they want. I talked about this with Atlantic Council analyst Sarah Biedenbaugh, and she looked at the whole proposal, and this is what she had to say. The Austrian put forth a plan establishing safe havens in the areas where those seeking asylum in the EU could be processed. I would imagine that states such as Hungary would say they ought to be in Serbia or in Macedonia. Conversely, if you were Macedonia or Serbia, you would say, why are we the ones who are going to hold and look after these people? And then you can pick and choose the ones you want. What's your reaction to this train of thought?
Yeah, I think that's a valid criticism. The previous proposals that the European Commission put out a few months ago with regards to the 40,000 that they attempted to resettle, one of those proposals was that we would have reception centers in the countries of origin. So you would have reception centers on Libyan soil and Syrian soil. But that also requires the agreement of the countries that are sending these migrants, and they have their own problems. So it's a very difficult situation and something that Macedonia, Serbia, those countries that are on the border are not going to be able to solve. I think you need both. you need a way to distinguish between legitimate humanitarian asylum seekers and those who are coming for other purposes. So there needs to be some way of processing those who wish to apply in a safe haven in their own country at the beginning. But then you can't ignore the fact that there's going to be some who are going to cross those borders. And when they do, you still have to have the mechanisms in place to be able to process and resettle them there.
The points also included increased controls on Europe's outer borders, coordinated action against human smuggling, and quotas for refugees for each of the European Union's 28 members. How viable is this plan? Will the other member states agree to it?
I think it's really clear that there's a long way to go. We still have a wide split. There's growing criticism over the EU's failure to kind of lead the way. And the realization that there's really an EU solution that's needed for this. The safe havens will be extremely important to this solution. I think when people are fleeing war and violence and famine, you first have to ensure that the personal safety of those individuals is taken care of. And, you know, without that, there's not going to be anything that the European Union can do to halt the movement of these people. Quotas in the EU, I think, is a lot less likely. We saw just a few months ago the EU tried to implement a voluntary quota system to resettle 40,000 refugees, and a lot of member states opted out, the UK in particular, and in the end, countries only agreed to allocate 32,000, and the current burden is much, much, much higher than that. So if there's going to be any way that we can have a quota system, it's going to require the agreement of all member states, which is still highly unlikely, and it's going to require a much bigger commitment than that they have already agreed to make. And then increased controls on outer borders. Again, this is difficult, but this is another important measure because the only way that we're going to be able to have agreement that all 28 member states are going to contribute to is that we have to reassure countries that are on the border, countries like Hungary, who are very, very worried about border control, something that can reassure them.
Sarah Biedenbaugh is the Associate Director for the European Union and Special Initiatives at the Atlantic Council.
Jeffrey, this is just a meeting that she basically says isn't going to work anyway, right?
Getting all 28 EU member states to accept quotas of migrants/refugees is a real uphill rock to push. Many of the member countries don't want any of them. It's not in my backyard, spread across the entire EU. The only two countries that have really shown any serious interest in accepting these people have been Sweden and Germany. Most of the other ones, you have nationalist parties, for instance, throwing up the scream, shut the doors, put a guard in front of it, no.
And even in Germany, I mean, Angela Merkel ran into a lot of opposition, you know, over the past week or so.
A couple of days ago in Germany, there was a school gymnasium that was supposed to be used to house refugees that was burned down. And they think that it was neo-nationalists who did this.
Well, this is a very difficult situation. We shall see what happens. Jeffrey Young from VOA and from International Edition, I thank you very much, as always, for being here.
Thank you, Andrew.
Let's move over to social media now. Andrew Palczewski, VOA social media editor, joins us, as he does every day. How is this being expressed in social media, or is it not? It's a very complicated story.
It is, and it's these two incidents that we're reading about today, one with this truck in Austria where the 71 migrants died, the other over 200 migrants that drowned in the Mediterranean trying to cross from Libya to Italy. These are kind of the catalysts on social media that are sparking a lot of outrage and drawing a lot of attention to this ongoing issue. So a lot of people reacting to those two incidents on social media. We're actually going to be talking about this on our show, #VOA, this upcoming Tuesday, looking at a lot of the reaction to these incidents and this ongoing migrant crisis. It's the biggest migrant crisis in Europe since World War II, which is the fact that a lot of people are pointing out. So we'll be covering that, and people can find that on Facebook.com/#VOA, Twitter.com/#VOA, and encourage them to tune in on Tuesday.
Well, you might have heard when we started the program, we talked about manspreading.
Yes.
This is a very difficult transition here, obviously. But coming up later in the program, we'll be talking about some new words and phrases that have been added to at least one dictionary. The Oxford Dictionary is online. And anything on social media on that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this has kind of become an annual tradition when Oxford's dictionary adds these words in. So you have people saying, oh, it's the time of year when they add in the new words. Awesome sauce, which is one of the words that they've added.
I hate that.
Somebody else saying the word hangry just got added to the Oxford Dictionary, which is a combination of hungry and angry. It's when you get upset when you don't have a lot of food, which is, happens to me when I don't eat lunch until late. So people are saying this is how real of a problem this is, that they added this word. And then one gentleman saying, I just learned that awesome sauce and other words have been added to the Oxford English Dictionary. I think I need a drink. And someone responded to him. It said, it's okay. Conveniently for you, beer o'clock and wine o'clock were also words that were added. So people having a lot of fun with it, saying, I'm so happy that certain words were added. Other people saying, I can't believe this word were added. But again, back and forth on social media and people trying to cram in the words to their tweets and sentences.
Well, coming up later, I will ask the woman from OxfordDictionaries.com whether or not manspreading, that term, is sexist.
And that's one of the terms that's actually kind of led the social media, because it's been an issue that a lot of women have brought up, and they are asking a lot of questions about, is it sexist? Is this a term that should be added to the dictionary? So a big debate on that, for sure.
We shall see what happens. This is International Edition, and this is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Renowned physicist and cosmologist Stephen Hawking recently said that he may have a solution to a 40-year-old cosmological mystery called the black hole information paradox. The theory of general relativity suggests that all physical information about an object would be permanently destroyed and lost after entering the black hole. However, this theory violates the laws of quantum mechanics. Hawking said that rather than actually swallowing and destroying this information, a black hole creates a 2D hologram of it. Garbled bits of information emitted by the hologram makes its way into the deep recesses of the black hole, where they, as Hawking suggested, could make their way out of the void via a passage to another universe. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. I'm in Washington, D.C. The southern U.S. city of New Orleans, devastated by Hurricane Katrina 10 years ago, is seeing back-to-back-to-back visits by U.S. presidents. Current President Barack Obama on Thursday, former President George W. Bush today, Friday, and former President Bill Clinton Saturday. Mr. Bush was president in 2005 when Hurricane Katrina broke through protective levees and flooded the city, killing 1,800 people and destroying 100,000 homes. The Bush administration was roundly criticized in the days following Katrina for a slow emergency response to the thousands of people needing shelter, supplies, and security. On Saturday, former President Clinton is scheduled to appear at a ceremony marking the anniversary of Katrina's landfall in New Orleans. Thursday, President Obama hailed the southern U.S. city's revival and the problems that had been exposed after the floodwaters receded.
The storm laid bare a deeper tragedy that had been brewing for decades, because we came to understand that New Orleans, like so many cities and communities across the country, had for too long been plagued by structural inequalities that left too many people, especially poor people, especially people of color.
Katrina caused more than $135 billion in damage, making it the costliest natural disaster ever in the United States. We welcome to International Edition Ramona Williamson, who went through the Katrina disaster a number of years ago now, and this is the anniversary. And Ramona, thanks for being with us. What are some of your chief remembrances of what happened during that time?
Well, I had evacuated with my family to my uncle's house in Baton Rouge, which is about a 90-minute drive away, and I remember him coming into the room where I was sitting. Actually, Monday, the storm hit, and then later that day, he came in and said, the levees are breaking, and I went back to in the other room to watch it on television, because we had lost power in Baton Rouge during the storm. And he said to me, as we watched the water flow into the city, so I had talked to one of my neighbors earlier in the morning who had stayed in St. Bernard, and he said, oh, your house is fine, everything's okay, I'm looking here, you might have a few shingles off, everything looks good. Then the levees broke, and my uncle said to me, for the rest of your life, time will be before Katrina and after Katrina.
What happened to your house?
According to the National Guard, when I first got back to my house, my father worked for the power company, so I was able to get back to my house fairly early, you know, maybe 2 weeks after the storm. And the National Guard was passing down my street in some sort of military vehicle, and they said, oh, we measured the water, because we talked to them a few minutes. We measured the water right here at the corner of your street, and there was 23 feet of water. So my house was totally underwater. I had seen pictures of it where you couldn't, there were boats going down my street, and you couldn't even see the roofs of houses. We had one two-story house on my street. Most of the other houses were ranch-style houses built in the 80s, and you could only see the one two-story house. Everything else was underwater. You couldn't even see the peaks of the roofs. So I came back. I got a FEMA trailer in March, returned to work as a teacher in June. My district actually opened the schools back up again in 6 weeks, and this is amazing because in my parish or county, every building had 6 feet of water at least. So within 6 weeks, our superintendent went out on her own because neither the state nor FEMA would help her and brought in FEMA trailers and opened a school in the parking lot of one of the houses.
What happened to your house? Have you ever been able to get back into it?
I was able to rebuild my house. I had it gutted in November of 2005. I began rebuilding it in the next May, I think. It took a while because they couldn't decide if my neighborhood was going to be allowed to rebuild. And finally, I just started rebuilding without permission, and I decided that if I had to move out, I would just worry about that later. And I moved back in the next spring. So spring of 2007, I had returned to my house.
What about the government's reaction? Local government, state government, federal government. In retrospect, what do you think of the way all of that was handled?
Well, I'll tell you a funny story that the first people to reach St. Bernard after Katrina were the Canadian Mounties 5 days later. And when our parish president asked the governor, why haven't you come to help us? Why was nothing done? Because we are on the river. They could have come right through the river. He was told, well, we thought since we didn't hear from you, you must be okay.
Ramona Williamson survived Katrina, we are glad to say, and she has been with us here on International Edition. Ramona, thank you so much for your time and your information.
Thanks.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington, D.C. Have you ever heard of the term manspreading? Well, perhaps not, but surely you have heard the term butt dialing. Yes, I'm guilty of that. According to OxfordDictionaries.com, both are now part of the English language. Joining us from New York is Catherine Connor Martin. She is head of U.S. Dictionaries for Oxford University Press. All right, Catherine, a definition, please. Manspreading.
Manspreading is the practice whereby a man, especially one traveling on public transportation, adopts a sitting position with his legs wide apart in such a way as to encroach on an adjacent seat or seats. So I think that's something that anyone who rides on trains, and certainly on the subway in New York City, it has seen happen.
Well, I've ridden subways in New York City, in Washington, D.C., in London, all over the world, and yes, I've seen it, but I got to say, I must ask, is this not sexist? Because what about women spreading, or shouldn't I go there?
Actually, the New York City subway currently has a campaign promoting politeness, and they don't say specifically that it's men who do the spreading, but it is definitely a picture of a male stick figure with the spreading. The woman is called out for having too many shopping bags. So you could say that that is a sexist presentation of gender politics in New York City. And as with many of those man words, last year the big man word was mansplaining. It's poking fun at the activities of men. But I suppose a person of either gender could sit like this.
Well, you've handled that very well with great political correctness. I appreciate that. Now, butt dialing, that's become a worldwide menace, and explained for the uninitiated, if you don't mind.
Butt dialing is inadvertently calling someone on a mobile phone in one's rear pocket. But I think we probably often use that more broadly for any kind of mistaken call. It's also called pocket dialing, when you mistakenly call or message or FaceTime someone because of a phone that's loose or pressed accidentally.
I looked at OxfordDictionaries.com, and I see these new words have been divided into categories geographically, as well as categories like business and entertainment. How about some other of the words that have now joined the English language, according to your publication?
Well, there are at least two words in this update that come from Japanese, and those are matcha, which is powdered green tea leaves, which are used to make tea, are also very common as a flavoring, and so matcha ice cream and things like that are increasingly popular in English-speaking countries, and mecha, which is in anime and manga, a large armored robot that is controlled by someone who's sitting inside the robot.
What goes into the decision as to whether or not these words and or phrases are brought into what you think should be a part of the English language?
The way we look at it is that we add words to the dictionary when they have become words in English. So we're just reflecting, we're a mirror that reflects what English-speaking people are doing all around the world.
Catherine Conner-Martin is head of U.S. Dictionaries for Oxford University Press. She joined us from New York. Catherine, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
You watch that manspreading, will you? That's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Ira Melman. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On August 25th, a Russian military court found Ukrainian filmmaker Oleg Sentsov and Ukrainian activist Oleksandr Kolchenko guilty of politically motivated fabricated charges and sentenced Mr. Sentsov to 20 years and Kolchenko to 10 years in prison. The charges against Mr. Sentsov and Mr. Kolchenko are baseless and violate their human rights. The case against them rested on testimony obtained through torture, which in at least one case was retracted because it had been coerced. Indeed, Russia singled out Sentsov and Kolchenko for exercising their freedom of speech within a sovereign Ukraine, where they expressed their vocal opposition to Russia's purported annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. On May 11, 2014, Russia's Federal Security Service arrested Oleg Sentsov at his home in Simferopol, Crimea, territory the international community recognizes as part of Ukraine and where Russia has no legal jurisdiction. A Ukrainian filmmaker whose work had garnered international attention, Sentsov had just taken part in a rally to support the Euromaidan protests in Kiev and to oppose Russia's occupation of Crimea. Similarly, Russian occupational authorities arrested Oleksandr Kolchenko, a pro-Ukrainian activist, 5 days later. Both were illegally transported to Russia, forcibly assigned Russian citizenship to deprive them of their rights as foreign citizens, and held in detention without trial for over a year. The United States strongly condemns the trial and sentencing of film director Oleg Sentsov and activist Oleksandr Kolchenko as groundless, a violation of human rights, and a contravention of international law. This is clear miscarriage of justice, said State Department spokesman John Kirby. Both Ukrainians were taken hostage on Ukrainian territory, transported to and imprisoned in Russia, and had Russian citizenship imposed on them against their wills. They have reported abuses by Russian authorities, who also restricted their access to lawyers, family, and others while in jail for more than a year. Mr. Sentsov and Mr. Kolchenko were targeted by authorities because of their opposition to Russia's attempted annexation of Crimea, said spokesperson Kirby. The United States stands by those who are persecuted for exercising their rights to speak freely and engage in peaceful protest. We again call upon the Russian Federation to implement the commitments it made in signing the Minsk agreements by immediately releasing Oleg Sentsov, Alexander Kolchenko, Nadia Savchenko, and all other remaining hostages.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.